Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the May 23rd, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows our new Pope, Leo the 14th. He's got on his usual papal robe, but there's a handwritten name tag pinned to it. It says Bob. And he's just standing in the backyard of a typical suburban American home. He's grilling hamburgers and hot dogs. He's smilingly admiring one of the hot dogs he's just cooked. There is a white fence around the backyard, typical shrubs, and looks like there's a cornhole game set up. He's also wearing a Chicago White Sox ball cap on his head. The headline is An American Pope, What Leo the 14th Means for the Catholic Church and the Country. That comes up on the Controversy of the Week. We'll start with the first main story. Trump defends $400 million jet gift on Mideast tour. What happened? President Trump this week embarked on a pomp-filled tour of the Middle East where he signed investment deals with Saudi Arabia, pledged to lift U.S. sanctions on Syria, made overtures to Iran, and sparked domestic uproar with his plan to accept Qatar's gift of a $400 million jet. Trump scoffed at ethical concerns about receiving a lavishly appointed Boeing 747-8 from Qatari royal family, saying the palace in the sky would be converted into an Air Force One and would go to his presidential library after he left office. Only a, quote, stupid person wouldn't want a free, very expensive airplane, said Trump. In a memo, Attorney General Pam Bondi, a former lobbyist for Qatar, declared the gift would not violate anti-bribery laws or the Constitution's ban on foreign gifts because it would go initially to the Defense Department. But even many Republicans balked at the plan. Qatar's rulers support Hamas, said Florida Senator Rick Scott. I don't know how you make the plane safe. As Trump arrived in Saudi Arabia, his first stop, he got a ceremonial escort from six Royal Saudi Air Force F-15s and was met by an honor guard with golden swords, sitting with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman under sparkling chandeliers in the royal palace. Trump praised the kingdom's de facto ruler as an incredible man and my friend. In Riyadh, Trump announced he would lift decades-old sanctions on Syria to give the war-ravaged country a chance at peace. The next day, he met with Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa, a former al-Qaeda militant who led the recent overthrow of dictator Bashar al-Assad, praising him as a tough guy. Trump noted that he decided to lift sanctions after a request from bin Salman. Oh, what I do for the crown prince, he said. Trump offered a new path to Iran, promising to ease sanctions if it abandoned its nuclear program and support of proxy militias. Should Tehran reject this olive branch, he said, we will have no choice but to inflict massive maximum pressure. During the trip, bin Salman committed to $600 billion in U.S. investments, including $142 billion in arms purchases. Qatar, Trump's second stop, pledged deals worth more than $243 billion, including $96 billion in Boeing jets for Qatar Airways. What the editorial said. Trump's belief that he can blithely accept a $400 million plane from Qatar is jaw-dropping, said the San Antonio Express News. It's a blatant act of self-enrichment and a clear violation of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, which forbids gifts for U.S. officials from any king, prince, or foreign state. That it technically goes to the Defense Department means nothing. The chief beneficiary would be a corrupt president who is easily swayed by flattery and presence. Making matters worse is that Qatar is no friend, said National Review. Its terrorist-loving government has long supported Yemen's Houthi militia and funneled billions to Hamas, helping the group build the infrastructure it needed for the October 7, 2023 massacre in Israel. It then blamed Israel for the slaughter and refused to use its leverage to help free Hamas hostages. Absolutely nothing good can come from a president feeling he owes something to such a regime. What the columnist said. Trump visited a region awash in tumult, from the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza to the missile exchanges between Israel and the Iran-backed Houthis, said Alex Shepard in the New Republic. But actual diplomacy on this trip was an afterthought. Instead, his focus was business, with an uneasy blurring between America's interests and those of Trump Incorporated. Eric and Don Jr. have been jaunting across the region, striking deals worth billions of dollars, including a high-end residential tower in Saudi Arabia and a golf course and villa complex in Qatar. Meanwhile, Trump's sidelining of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is unnerving Israelis, said Jerry Shi in The Washington Post. His failure to visit Jerusalem comes amid other signs of cracks between the staunch allies. The U.S. is engaged in hostage talks with Hamas without Israel's knowledge, struck a truce with the Houthis that didn't protect Israel, and moved to start nuclear negotiations with Iran while vetoing an Israeli strike on its enemy. Many Israelis now fear they're being cast off by a president they consider to be the most pro-Israel in history. It's telling that for the first planned trip of his second term, Trump chose not a democracy, but a despotism, said William Crystal in The Bulwark. As his gushing praise of bin Salman, a global pariah after he ordered the 2018 murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, made clear, he admires the Saudi achievements in autocracy, plutocracy, and kleptocracy. Indeed, in remarks at a business summit in Riyadh, he condemned the so-called nation builders, neocons, or liberal nonprofits, who have promoted democracy and liberalism in the region. Since Trump returned to office, the specter of authoritarianism has sparked wide alarm, said Edward Luce in Financial Times. But autocracy's twin is kleptocracy, and on that front, Trump seemed much further advanced. The Trump family's crypto ventures are raking in millions. His sons are building a Trump-branded golf resort in Qatar, which is also a major investor in his son-in-law Jared Kushner's investment fund. It'd be fair to ask the America First president how any of this serves U.S. interest. The suspicion arises that the president's real agenda is Trump first, and the rest is sleight of hand. Controversy of the week. Leo XIV, what an American Pope can teach America. Growing up, the only white smoke young Robert Prevost ever saw likely billowed from steelwork chimneys on Chicago's South Side, said Thomas Dija in The Observer. Last week, white smoke from the Vatican signaled that he'd been elected the first North American Pope in the history of the Catholic Church. Adopting the name Leo XIV, the new pontiff addressed the crowds in St. Peter's Square, first in Italian, then in Spanish, and concluded with a traditional blessing in Latin. But make no mistake, the new leader of the world's 1.4 billion Catholics, is a true son of Chicago. Known to friends as Bob, he's a White Sox fan from the intimate and humane city that gave the world Barack Obama, deep dish pizza, and Playboy magazine. The Cardinals' choice of an American has stunned the Roman Catholic world, said Jason Horowitz in the New York Times. It breaks an old taboo against aligning papal authority with the world's dominant superpower. But Prevost, a young but not too young 69, spent 20 years ministering to the poor in Peru, acquiring a Peruvian passport along the way, and the fact that he was born in a wealthy nation whose donors are vital to the church's finances may have ultimately worked in his favor. The new pope is American, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark, but do not, for one second, think this is about us. Within minutes of Leo's election, MAGA keyboard warriors had surfaced a social media account bearing Prevost's name that had reposted articles criticizing the Trump administration's deportation policies and declared Vice President J.D. Vance wrong for interpreting Catholic doctrine as opposing foreign aid. To MAGA influencer Laura Loomer, that made Leo a woke Marxist pope, presumably elected to give Trump a new nemesis. In reality, Leo's message of peace, he used his first Sunday blessing to call for ceasefires in Gaza and Ukraine, and compassion for the downtrodden just means he's a Catholic. We'll never know exactly why the Cardinals picked him, but trust me that no one in the Sistine Chapel was thinking about Trump. Really? Said Jill Filipovich in the Daily Beast. The Trump years have seen the rise of a hard-right Catholic opposition to the values of empathy and tolerance that Pope Francis preached. Liberals shouldn't kid themselves that any pope will hold progressive views on abortion, say, or gay marriage. And Leo's past statements suggest he's a traditional conservative on those issues. But the choice of an American pope committed to decency was likely meant as a corrective to the harsh new Catholicism of Vance. Actually, said Michael Brendan Doherty in National Review, Leo has already walked back some of Francis' modernist reforms. They are small things, but by speaking in confident Latin and choosing a traditional papal name, Leo has signaled to conservatives that he'll be a major improvement over progressive, emotive Francis. Leo is neither MAGA nor woke, said David French in the New York Times. But the example of an American running an ancient church could inspire our brash young nation to widen its frame of reference and stop elevating the temporal over the eternal. For Americans, the Pope has always been unreachable and otherworldly, said Molly Wilson O'Reilly in MSNBC.com. Now he's one of us, able to speak to us directly with no need for a translator. Sooner or later, Pope Leo from Chicago, flat vowels and all, may choose to engage with us, his countrymen. The question is whether Americans are prepared to listen. And our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for making the most of it. After Dutch scientists concluded that the universe will die much sooner than expected, with all stars set to burn out in 10 to the power of 78 years. That's a 1 with 78 zeros, rather than the previous estimate of 10 to the power of 1,100 years. It's a good week for Charlie Hustle. After the MLB removed Pete Rose and other deceased players from its permanently banned list, making them eligible to be considered for induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Rose, who was placed on the list for gambling, is no longer with us, said MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred, so cannot represent a threat to the integrity of the game. It was a good week for pathogens. After Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. posted photos of himself and his grandkids swimming in Washington, D.C.'s Rock Creek, a sewer runoff with high levels of bacteria. Contact with the water, notes the National Park Service, poses a hazard to human and pet health. But it was a bad week for the dark side. After a British woman whose psychological makeup was likened by a colleague to that of Darth Vader was awarded $40,000 in compensation. Judge Catherine Ramsden was unmoved by defense claims that the Sith Lord is a very focused individual who can bring teams together, ruling that Vader is a legendary villain. It's a bad week for flaunting it. After the Cannes Film Festival banned nudity on the red carpet for reasons of decency, as well as prohibiting the kind of beyond-revealing outfits worn by celebrities like Bella Hadid, the new code also restricts voluminous outfits, particularly those with a large train. Finally, it was a bad week for goodie bags. After Detroit police shut down the legendary Sting Strip Club for hosting a birthday party attended by more than 20 minors, some as young as 14. "We will not tolerate this in the city of Detroit," said Police Chief Todd Bettison. "Not at this establishment or any other." In the briefing, return of the wild wolf. Gray wolves have been brought back from the brink of extinction in the U.S. Is that a good thing? How big is the U.S. wolf population? The lower 48 states are now home to about 6,000 gray wolves, concentrated mostly in the northern Rocky Mountains and around the Great Lakes. It's a remarkable comeback for an animal once almost wiped out by hunters. There were as few as 300 wolves in the contiguous U.S. in 1960, down from an estimated 2 million in North America in the 1600s. The species has also rebounded in Western Europe, where some 21,500 wolves now roam. But that revival hasn't been welcomed by farmers and ranchers, who say the predators threaten their livestock and their livelihoods. As a result, clashes over wolves have erupted everywhere from Colorado, where voters in 2020 approved a ballot proposition to introduce 30 to 50 wolves over 5 years, to the European Parliament, where lawmakers last week voted to make it easier for farmers to shoot the canines. Wolf advocates say ranchers' fears are overblown. In 2015, wolves in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho killed 148 cattle, 208 sheep, 3 dogs, and 3 horses. That's a tiny percentage of the hundreds of thousands of animals lost each year to illness, weather, and other non-predator causes. But Colorado rancher Jeff Myers says it's easy for wolf reintroduction supporters to dismiss those losses because few of them work the land. "It's not your calves that are going to be killed," he said. "It's not your border collie." Why did the wolf populations decline in the first place? It was a product of manifest destiny and the westward expansion of the U.S. in the 1800s, which sought to tame the land and its wild inhabitants, said conservation biologist Mike Phillips. The hunting of wolves was aided by historical cultural prejudices against the animals, think Little Red Riding Hood, and even President Theodore Roosevelt, a famed conservationist, considered the wolf a beast of waste and desolation. The federal government subsidized the shooting, trapping, and poisoning of wolves starting in 1915, and by the 1940s, the animals were extinct in the northern Rockies. Only a few hundred gray wolves remained in the U.S., mostly in the upper Midwest. How did the wolves bounce back? They were helped by the birth of the modern conservation movement, which adopted the wolf as a symbol of the nation's disappearing wild heritage. "We have a psychological need for something big and bad that represents wildness," said wildlife ecologist Jim Halfpenny, wolves fulfill that. Wildlife experts also began to understand how the apex predators help manage an ecosystem, keeping in check deer populations that would otherwise strip vegetation bare. Thanks to the shift in public opinion, the wolf was among the first animals to gain federal protections under the 1973 Endangered Species Act. Their numbers steadily grew, aided by human intervention. From 1995 to 1997, 41 wolves from Canada and Montana were released in Yellowstone. The national park is now home to about 110 wolves, dispersed among 9 packs. Park officials estimate that each wolf is worth about $1 million because of the visitors the wolves attract. Have they helped the ecosystem? In Yellowstone, the wolves reduced the park's booming and overgrazing elk population. Some experts say that led to a trophic cascade, a chain reaction set off in an ecosystem by addition or removal of a top predator. Doug Smith, former head of the Yellowstone Wolf Project, said predatory wolves keep elk on the move, so they no longer linger by streams and gobble up new growth of willows, a crucial food source for beavers in the winter. As a result, Smith said, the park's beaver population has increased, and those beavers have in turn created dams and ponds that become habitats for birds and fish. Other experts doubt whether wolves are really an ecological silver bullet. Daniel Stoller, Yellowstone's lead wolf biologist, said that at best have ushered in a trophic trickle, and residents in surrounding areas where Yellowstone's packs often roam say they've paid too high a price for any ecological gains. Hunting guides say the drop in elk has hurt their business, and ranchers that prowling wolves kill and also stress their livestock, reducing their weight. Under pressure from voters, lawmakers have moved to reduce protection for wolves. How have they done that? Congress in 2011 removed wolves in the Northern Rockies from the endangered species list, and wolves are now killed by the hundreds in annual hunting sessions in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. The Trump administration in 2020 removed gray wolves entirely from the Endangered Species Act, citing a successful recovery, and 4 months later, Wisconsin authorized a wolf hunt in breeding season. Hunters killed 218 wolves in 3 days, far above their 119 kill limit, and soon state legislatures in the West began authorizing wolf hunting. That flurry of hunting legislation was 1850s stuff, said Ed Bangs, a biologist who led wolf recovery in the Northern Rockies for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Let's show how much we hate wolves and the people who like them, and let's stick it to the feds. In 2022, a federal judge restored wolves' endangered species status outside the Northern Rockies. Can tensions over wolves be lowered? Compensating farmers for livestock killed by wolves can help. But Colorado, where wolves were reintroduced in 2023, almost depleted its $350,000 annual compensation fund after a string of attacks in the first 3 months of this year. Federal grants and state compensation program funds have also been used in some states to pay for electric fencing and non-lethal deterrence at ranches targeted by wolves. Many experts say that transparency and communication between farmers, conservationists, and government officials are key to human and wolf coexistence. Wolves can be tracked with GPS collars, for example, and ranchers told when they're near their property. Wolf recovery is all about people, said wildlife biologist Diane Boyd, and very little about wolves. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. The alarming threats to air safety. What's happening at Newark Liberty International Airport is not just troubling, it's terrifying, said Jason Matsis. A burned-out copper wire recently caused a 90-second communications blackout at a radar facility serving Newark, leaving air traffic controllers blind and mute while planes full of passengers descended into one of the country's busiest airports. Two more outages have occurred since then, causing hundreds of flight delays and cancellations. More than 20% of Newark's air traffic controllers have taken leave, with some reporting symptoms consistent with trauma. And they say the airport is unsafe. The FAA has a long-standing national shortage of 3,000 air traffic controllers who take 3 years to train, and these critical workers rely on antiquated technology that should have been replaced decades ago. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has announced plans to upgrade air traffic control systems nationwide, but that could take years. Only sheer luck and pilot skill have prevented tragedy at Newark. We can't keep gambling with safety. Until Newark is fully staffed and modernized, the FAA must reduce its flight schedule. Otherwise, the consequences could be swift, devastating, and unforgiving. A good death need not be hastened. As a doctor, I've seen intensive care units full of gravely ill people being kept alive by tortuous artificial means, said L.S. Dugdale. So I support efforts to provide a better death. That's the supposed goal of the Medical Aid in Dying Act, recently passed by New York State Assembly. But the bill, modeled on similar laws already in effect in Oregon and Canada, is not about dying well. Instead, it's about relieving society of responsibility to care for people in despair because of loneliness, poverty, depression, and disability. The bill would authorize doctors to give qualifying patients lethal drugs they can self-administer. But it doesn't require most recipients to be screened for depression. Of the 607 Oregonians receiving lethal prescriptions last year, only three were referred for psychiatric evaluation. In 2023 in Canada, hundreds received assisted suicide were people with disabilities who said they lacked support services, and half of non-terminal patients choosing to die cited loneliness as a factor. Offering a hastened death to people who see themselves as worthless burdens is not a compassionate policy. Instead, let's offer them a good death, in which life ends amid support, comfort, and dignity. This column comes from France. Back to the days of Balzac. France's social elevator has gotten stuck, said Beatrice Madeleine. The wealthy aren't those who work hard, save, and invest. They are the lucky ones whose parents passed down a fortune. In the 1970s, inherited money represented about 35% of the nation's wealth. That figure is now a stunning 60%, and it will only climb higher as baby boomers pass on some $760 billion to their children every year. With the richest 10% now controlling 80% of French assets, we're back to the stratification of the 19th century. How did we get here? It started in the 1970s when growth slowed, which meant workers' income didn't rise much. Yet the real estate market and the stock market were simultaneously booming. So those who already had wealth amassed even more. Then in the 1980s, tax reforms gradually eroded progressivity to the point where the inheritance tax is riddled with many exemptions, deductions, and loopholes. Now it takes over six generations for a French person in the bottom 10% of income to reach the median, longer than an American, five generations, or the average EU citizen, four and a half. This inability to get ahead is fueling middle-class resentment, and killing the entrepreneurial spirit. It's as if we've been transported into a Balzac novel where the only way to get ahead is to marry a young heiress. The last word, our feature article, Life in the News Desert. The residents of Oakdale have abandoned traditional media outlets for a mishmash of online sources, said Eli Tan in the New York Times. These days, they're often not sure what information to trust. Oakdale, California. With its horse-trodden roads, endless fields of almond blossoms, and cowboy heritage, this 20,000-person town fits the American West of imagination. And for decades, its media diet was classically all-American, too. Nightly news broadcasts played on living room televisions. Copies of local newspapers lined doorsteps on Sunday mornings. The town even had two media outlets dedicated to rodeo and horse-roping news. But that version of Oakdale is a thing of the past. First, the nearby newspapers shrank, and hundreds of local reporters in the region became handfuls. Then came the presidential elections of 2016 and 2020, and the pandemic. Suddenly, cable networks, long deemed trustworthy, were peddlers of fake news on the right and the left. By 2024 election, when its county, Stanislaus, was among the 10 in California that President Trump flipped red, it wasn't just trust in traditional media that had vanished from Oakdale. It was the media itself. Now in place of longtime TV pundits and radio hosts, residents turned to a new sphere of podcasters and online influencers to get their political news. Facebook groups for local events run by residents have replaced the role of local newspapers, elevating the county's keyboard warriors to roles akin to editors-in-chief. Of the 80 Oakdale residents to whom the New York Times spoke for this article, not one subscribed to a regional news site, the Times, the Wall Street Journal, or the Washington Post. Oakdale is not alone. Between news deserts expanding in rural areas and a growing distrust of national outlets, the town's shift toward new sources of information is becoming commonplace in small communities across the country. But seeking truth in a post-journalism world of Facebook groups and online influencers has left some Oakdale residents feeling less informed than before. In efforts to manage misinformation that culminated in an armed militia storming the town in 2020, have changed the very nature of the community. Tucked between mountain ranges and rivers in the heart of California's Central Valley, Oakdale is only 100 miles east of the San Francisco Bay Area, but it has the feel of another world. It's a place where highways are dotted with fruit stands and where neighbors leave baked goods on one another's porches, with a large community of Latino immigrants and a proud cowboy history, memorialized in two separate museums. During the pandemic, the town became especially tight-knit, bonded by the uncertainty of the virus, the politics of an election year, and the hardship of closing down restaurants and retail stores in a place where small businesses are an economic lifeblood. As local news outlets shrank throughout the Central Valley in the 2010s, Facebook groups dedicated to local events started popping up in their place. And for years, they were harmless. That changed in 2020. With residents stuck at home during the pandemic, the groups thrived. But as new members joined by the thousands, conspiracy theories and political debates overtook posts about school board meetings and local elections. Then the militia incident happened. Julie Logan, an in-home health care worker in Oakdale, can still remember the scene. It was a weekend morning in June, and the downtown farmers market had been replaced by a scene resembling a military operation. Gunmen patrolled the sidewalks, dressed head to toe in brown camouflage. Store windows were boarded up. Some of the men perched from the rooftops in tactical gear, brandishing rifles. The militia was prepared to defend against an imminent threat. Black Lives Matter protesters, they believed, were plotting to invade the town and would be arriving on buses from the Bay Area at any moment. They waited and waited. But the protesters never came. The men were drawn to Oakdale by a false rumor spread in a Facebook group called All Things Oakdale, which over the years had become the town's primary forum for local news. Started in 2015 by Logan, the group had amassed more than 17,000 members by 2020. "That was the moment we knew something had to change," she said. "We were overwhelmed." The militia was hired by the owner of a downtown bar called the HB Saloon, police said. The scene confused even local authorities, said, and Jeff Dursky, the sheriff of Stanislaus County, took to Facebook to decry rumors that are running rampant on social media, but assured residents there was no threat of an attack. Reached by phone, the owner of HB Saloon declined to comment. Logan made the Facebook group private and banned political discussions altogether. To help with fact-checking and moderation, she enlisted Carrie Conversa, a pet care store owner, and Christopher Smith, an Oakdale City Council member and commercial plumbing distribution manager. But the new focus on moderation had an unintended effect. Frustrated residents whose comments were removed began to create their own groups in protest, with names such as Oakdale Incident Feed First Amendment Approved and Oakdale Incident Feed Unfiltered. Soon enough, the spinoffs were becoming more popular than the original group. Among the largest of the new Facebook groups is Stanislaus News, which has 75,000 members and has become the go-to source of information for crime in the area. The sprawling county has about 500,000 residents. The group was founded by Mark Davis, a former bail bond salesperson in the nearby city of Modesto, who was banned from a different group dedicated to local news in 2019. Along with his wife, Davis spends hours a day monitoring local police and emergency service scanners, translating the radio codes into updates that are often posted hours before local news reports. The group has also become a repository for Davis' personal musings about Trump and Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, to the frustration of many residents who just want to read about local happenings. "This page was not intended for political purposes," one commenter wrote on a recent post about Musk. The group is closely aligned with the Modesto Police Department, which uses it to make daily posts of its own. "This is a pro-law enforcement group," reads one of Davis' rules. "If you are not, then this is not a group for you." Some residents say Davis' rules have hurt their efforts to spread important news, as in December when surveillance footage posted to the group of a fatal shooting at a convenience store appeared to contradict the sheriff's report of how the altercation began. Members of the group began to post new details about the case until Davis stepped in to ban them. Blake Coronado, who runs a nonprofit that helps find missing people and relies on Facebook groups for engagement, was one of the members who posted. After visiting the crime scene in person to share his findings, Coronado said, comments on his post were disabled within minutes. A day later, he was banned. "I was shocked because, to my knowledge, we didn't even break any rules," said the interview. "If we're not going to hold our police department accountable, how is that helping our community?" Local news around Oakdale hasn't always been this way. In the early 2000s, the Modesto Bee, the largest regional paper owned by newspaper chain McClatchy, had more than 100 reporters, and now has about a dozen. Both of its former rodeo and horse roping news outlets are now out of business. The town is still able to support a weekly newspaper called the Oakdale Leader, which shares a handful of reporters with 9 other local newspapers in the Central Valley, all owned by Hank Vanderveen, its publisher and former circulation director at the Bee. "We're not trying to compete with it," Vanderveen said of the Facebook groups in an interview. "I still feel like some people go to us, whether it's our website or our newspaper, for more trusted news." It isn't just local news habits that are changing in Oakdale. Since the pandemic, a wider skepticism about everything, including vaccines and the price of eggs, has changed the way people approach information in general. The thinking is, do your own research and trust neither side. Fred Smith, a gun store owner in Oakdale, grew up watching broadcasts of CBS anchor Walter Cronkite when he was called the most trusted man in America. Until recently, Smith was a regular viewer of CNN and Fox News after work, and estimates he spent more than $100,000 advertising his store in the print pages of the Bee in the early 2000s. But that trust has waned as traditional cable outlets have started to feel more like entertainment than news, he said. He has gravitated toward podcasters such as Joe Rogan and Sean Ryan, fellow veteran, but he doesn't necessarily trust all the information on those podcasts either. "It used to be you had one source of news and you trusted it," Smith said. "Now the news comes from everywhere, and I take it all with a grain of salt." He now finds himself inundated with more news than he's ever felt in his lifetime, and he doesn't trust any of it. Asked if he ever gets his news from social media, Smith opened his Instagram feed to show an artificial intelligence-generated image of Trump riding a bald eagle. "You can't trust that either," he said. Working alongside Smith at his gun store is Jimmy Freeman, 50, who is known around the shop as a news hound. But whatever trust Freeman had in the mainstream media disappeared during the last presidential debate between Trump and then-President Joe Biden. Watch Biden struggle to string together complete sentences. He couldn't help thinking that the press corps in Washington that was supposed to keep the country informed had let him down. "It felt like a failure," Freeman said. "How could the media not tell us what we were seeing?" His solution to what he saw as media bias was a website called Ground News, which aggregates reports from different news outlets and gives them each a bias score on the spectrum of left, center, and right, along with a factuality rating. Users can even toggle between AI-generated summaries of news stories written from different political perspectives. You grab both sides, bring them toward the middle, and that's usually where the truth is, Freeman said. At $8 a month, it's the only news subscription he pays for. Liberal residents in Oakdale say their news diets haven't changed as much as those of their conservative counterparts. Harvey Melgoza, 67, still listens to MSNBC on the radio while working at his shoe repair store downtown, as he has for as long as he can remember. And he will sometimes read the Oakdale Leader with his neighbor, Doug, drops off extra copies at his doorstep. Since the start of the pandemic, he has watched some of his neighbors embrace conspiracy theories or grow suddenly fearful of Mexican immigrants coming across the border. MSNBC might sometimes have a bias, he said, but at least it gives me a good sense of what's happening in the world. On April 5th, dozens of Oakdale residents prepared to protest Trump and Musk in Modesto, among the hundreds of protests happening that day around the country. Flyers with details of the event were being deleted from Facebook groups, so they turned to email threads to share information instead. Marjorie Sturdy, a therapist at Oakdale and the leader of the town's progressive club, drove to the protest that day with a pit of anxiety in her stomach, remembering the militia 5 years ago. Then came some relief. Modesto police assured her in private that it was monitoring Facebook for dangerous threats. Aside from a few angry passersby, the rally drew hundreds and went on as planned. It gave me some optimism, Sturdy said, that things could change. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. Read one of the business columns today. Crypto, the Trump family business. With crypto, President Trump has found an unnervingly effective way to transmute the clout and power of the nation's highest office into cold, hard cash, said Will Gottsagen in The Atlantic. Since last fall, his family has launched several new crypto ventures, including a $Trump meme coin that has no underlying business fundamentals or links to real-world assets. But Trump announced recently that the top 220 buyers of Trump coin would get to dine with him at his golf course, a contest that raised nearly $150 million from mostly foreign investors. Someone looking to gain access to Trump might have once had to pay thousands of dollars a night for a room at Mar-a-Lago and hope to run into him on the golf course. Now anyone in the world with an internet connection can funnel money directly into the president's pockets. Separate from the Trump coin, the president and his sons Eric and Don Jr. launched a startup, World Liberty Financial, to operate as a new type of internet bank, said Eric Lipton and David Yaff Bellany in the New York Times. The bank holds huge stockpiles of crypto assets, benefiting directly from the president's cheerleading from the Oval Office. It has produced a cryptocurrency called WLFI and pockets 75% of the proceeds, creating yet another avenue for foreign businesses to curry favor with the Trump family. In March, the company also created a stablecoin, a type of digital currency designed to maintain the price of $1. An Abu Dhabi-backed firm recently used the Trump stablecoin to make a $2 billion investment, in essence giving World Liberty $2 billion in deposits to invest with one deal. Senate Democrats last week finally confronted Trump's brazen crypto profiteering, said Molly Roberts in the Washington Post. Nine Democrats, including four who had previously supported the proposal, stood up to block a bipartisan bill to regulate stablecoins, calling a pause to assess Trump's conflicts of interest. There is an argument for bringing clear regulation to the crypto industry, said the Boston Globe in an editorial. But Trump's greed has poisoned any meaningful discussion around crypto. Not being in power, there is little that Democrats can do to regulate these schemes or slow the Trump family's profiteering. But they can connect the dots for all those Trump voters who said they wanted to drain the swamp. The president is filling it almost daily with a fire hose. Influence peddling from the White House is not unprecedented, said Andrew C. McCarthy in National Review. Both the Clinton and Biden families leveraged the prestige and influence of association with the presidency. However, the $27 million Republicans traced from foreign agents into the Biden family coffers is a pittance compared with the dollar figures we're talking about with Trump. Trump and his family are selling access to the president, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The optics of nakedly boosting the Trump family fortune with crypto sales are awful, and the likely Democratic midterm campaign ads right themselves. Millions in secretive crypto profits for the Trump family, fewer dollars for everyone else. We'll do one of the health and science pieces. The man who let snakes bite him. A Wisconsin man who spent 18 years deliberately exposing himself to snake venom has helped scientists develop what may prove a universal anti-venom. Tim Freed, a former construction worker and self-taught snake expert, wanted to build up immunity to all the venomous species. So he self-administered more than 850 doses, around 200 from bites and the rest from injections. The first time he allowed himself to be bitten by an Egyptian cobra and then a monocle cobra an hour later, he spent 4 days in a coma. Undeterred, he kept at it and posted about his experiments on social media. When immunologist Jacob Glanville approached him in 2017, Freed told him, "I've been waiting years for this phone call." Glanville and his team developed an antivenom from Freed's antibodies, and a study in mice showed it fully or partially neutralized the venom of 19 of the world's deadliest snakes, including the black mamba, king cobra, and taipan. If human trials are successful, it could save lives. Tens of thousands of people die from snake bites every year. "It's an overwhelming feeling," Freed tells the Washington Post, "knowing that what I'm doing someday can change, it already has, medical history." And we'll finish up on the Talking Points page. I have an article here, Medicaid. Will millions lose coverage? "Stripping health care from the poor to help the rich sounds pretty heartless," said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. "But that's exactly what House Republicans' proposal to overhaul Medicaid will do. Released this week as part of a sweeping bill to implement President Trump's domestic agenda, the plan would require most low-income, childless recipients under age 65 to work at least 80 hours a month. Out-of-pocket costs would be introduced for some services, and a cap would be placed on a health care provider tax that states use to secure extra federal Medicaid funding. All told, the plan would cause an additional 8.6 million Americans to become uninsured, according to nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, while states would have to shoulder a far greater share of cost. But the $900 billion saved over a decade would partially finance the GOP's bill's $5 trillion in tax cuts that are skewed toward businesses and the wealthy. Should this legislation pass as is, it would add up to possibly the largest single transfer of wealth from poor to rich in U.S. history. The real problem is that squeamish GOP moderates are shying away from bigger cuts, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. Largely because of its expansion under Obamacare, Medicaid is now the fastest-growing federal program, with more than 20 million able-bodied adults joining its roll from 2013 to 2022. House spending hawks want to refocus Medicaid on helping the vulnerable communities it was created to help, children, pregnant women, and the elderly. But centrists want to keep Medicaid expansion dollars flowing to their blue states. Resistance to steeper cuts isn't just coming from blue state moderates, said Keneal Patterson in the Daily Beast. MAGA populist Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, where 1 in 5 residents are Medicaid recipients, warned in a scathing New York Times op-ed this week that slashing the program would be morally wrong and politically suicidal, risking a working-class electoral rebellion. "Republicans know their agenda is deeply unpopular," said Carl Hulse in the New York Times. "That's why House lawmakers and President Trump keep insisting they want to target waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicaid, all without cutting off assistance to a single eligible person. The flaw in that argument is that Medicaid cuts of the scope they're proposing could torpedo state budgets and cause millions of hardworking Americans to lose coverage, facts that Democrats will not let go unnoticed. As the bill works its way through Congress in the coming weeks, selling the message of pain-free cuts is going to get more than a little tricky." And time for a few of the shorter notes. At least 44 contracts terminated by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency have been resurrected by government agencies, reversing more than $220 million in supposed cost-cutting. On its wall of receipts, Doge lists 43 of those contracts as terminated and includes them in its tally of $32 billion in supposed savings. President Trump has met with intelligence officials for the president's daily brief only 12 times since his swearing in. That's a sharp drop from his first term when he met with intel officials twice a week and a rate well below that of his predecessors. Trump is also known not to read daily briefing documents that cover global affairs, national security threats, and covert U.S. operations. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration will no longer update its list of hurricanes, wildfires, droughts, and other weather-related disasters that cause at least $1 billion in damage as part of a wider rollback of government-funded climate research. The number of billion-dollar disasters in the U.S. has soared from about 3 a year in the 1980s to an average of 23 a year from 2020 through 2024. And we'll finish out today's show with a quote from Carl Jung, quoted in Investor's Business Daily, who says, "The world will ask you who you are, and if you don't know, the world will tell you." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.